Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katya Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at the rise of book bans in the United States. Over the past years, an increasing number of popular children's books have been removed from libraries across the US. Some parents say they have legitimate concerns. Others claim this is simply censorship. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Unmissable stories from around the globe. From the BBC World Service.
My happy place, this is who I am.
Search for the documentary, Lives Less Ordinary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 18th of January, these are our main stories. Pakistan has carried out targeted strikes against what it calls terrorist hideouts in Iran 2 days after similar Iranian airstrikes on Pakistani soil. Israeli forces are continuing their assault on Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, with fierce fighting now close to the biggest hospital still operating in the territory. A court in Thailand has sentenced a man to 50 years in prison for social media posts deemed insulting to the country's monarchy. Also in this podcast, the winner of a prestigious literary award in Japan reveals that part of it was written by the chatbot, GPT. Should she give the prize back? In what seems to be a tit-for-tat exchange, Pakistan has carried out a series of deadly military strikes on Iran. Tehran has strongly condemned the attacks, which it said had killed at least 9 people. This comes 2 days after Iran itself carried out cross-border missile strikes. Each side has accused the other of killing children during their attacks. Pakistan's military response follows diplomatic protests. On Wednesday, Islamabad recalled its ambassador from Tehran and blocked Iran's envoy from returning to his post in Pakistan. In similar language to that used by Tehran after its attacks, a Pakistani foreign ministry spokeswoman, Mumtaz Zahra Baluch, insisted her country was not targeting Iran, but terrorist groups operating there.
Pakistan undertook a series of highly coordinated and specifically targeted precision military strikes against terrorist hideouts in Sistan-o-Baluchistan province of Iran. A number of terrorists were killed during the intelligence-based operation. This morning's action was taken in light of credible intelligence of impending large-scale terrorist activities against Pakistan by these terrorists.
I asked our correspondent in Islamabad, Caroline Davies, whether Pakistan strikes on Iran were a one-off tit-for-tat or part of an escalating crisis.
That is going to be the big question. What does Iran do next? Looking at a lot of the language here, there's been real mirroring between what Pakistan has said and what Iran has said. As you say, this all started when Iran launched an attack and then admitted to launching an attack on militants inside Pakistan's borders. Now, this has been an ongoing point of disagreement between Pakistan and Iran. Both sides accuse the other of harbouring terrorist groups that then come across the border, launch attacks inside the country and then are able to flee to the other side of the border, which makes it very difficult for that country to then follow and try to get any form of justice for what has just happened. So that is the backdrop to all of this. As well, I think it's important to understand that Iran has, in the course of the last few days, also launched attacks that have hit inside other countries as well, inside Syria, inside Iraq, and now inside Pakistan. That seems to be that Iran is trying to show this display of strength, of force, saying that anything that it considers, any group it considers to be a threat, it will target. Now, the relationship normally between Pakistan and Iran is normally fairly cordial, and Pakistan reacted with real condemnation when Iran launched these attacks on Tuesday. As you say, they initially repelled and asked the Iranian ambassador to Pakistan not to come back to the country, but then we saw this military action overnight. Now, interestingly, Pakistan has said this is because they thought that there was going to be an imminent terrorist attack organised by these militants inside Iran. Now, most analysts are seeing that's not very credible because, of course, this is the context in which this has happened. Both sides are still trying to create this language, talking about militant groups, not the other country.
Caroline, do you think there's an element of domestic politics at play here? Because there are elections coming up quite soon in Pakistan.
There are elections coming up in Pakistan, and at the same time, Pakistan's military, its popularity has taken a real battering in the course of the last year or so. Many people are incredibly critical inside Pakistan of the way that they see that the establishment, which is the shorthand term here for Pakistan's military and intelligence services, the way that they have reacted to Imran Khan and his party. Imran Khan, of course, is still in prison at the moment. And their popularity is pretty low. There may be a suggestion that this might give the military here in Pakistan a bit of a boost of popularity. We don't know whether or not that's anything to do with why this attack has now happened. And we also don't know how long-lived that boost might be.
Our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davies. More than 100 days after Hamas's attack on Israel, the Israeli military is continuing to rain down bombs on Gaza as part of its campaign to eradicate the group. Israeli soldiers are engaged in a fierce assault on the southern city of Khan Yunis, with fighting now close to the biggest hospital still operating in the territory, Al-Nusra. Thousands of displaced civilians who'd taken shelter there are reported to have fled in panic. Meanwhile, there's no confirmation on whether medicines brought into Gaza for the hostages being held there, as part of a deal brokered by Qatar and France, have been given to their intended recipients, some of whom have chronic illnesses. A senior member of Hamas said that for every box of medicine earmarked for the hostages, 1,000 boxes would be delivered to Gaza residents. The deal was also supposed to see an increase in aid for Gazans, 85% of whom have been displaced. A spokesperson for the UN's World Food Programme, Abe Etefa, told the BBC that help couldn't come soon enough.
The situation for the last few weeks has been very difficult. Everyone in Gaza is hungry. Each day is a desperate search for food. I think the bombardments are nonstop. And with our latest data, every day passes, the risk of famine increases because the conflict limits the delivery of the life-saving humanitarian assistance to most people in need. So after 100 days, three agencies have called for the lifting of all barriers and the restrictions on aid delivery to be lifted to and within Gaza.
The Israeli president, Isaac Herzog, defended Israel's actions and said his country had been left with no choice.
I'm not shying away from the human tragedy in Gaza. And you want to know something? We care. We care. It is painful for us that our neighbors are suffering so much. But how else can we defend ourselves if our enemies decided to entrench themselves in an infrastructure of terror of unbelievable size?
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Joe Flotto, told us more about the deal to bring medicines and increased aid into Gaza.
This was a deal that was announced somewhat prematurely last week by the Israeli government and then confirmed a couple of nights ago by the Qataris. We know that these medicines have now entered the Gaza Strip, and alongside, as you mentioned, the medicines for the Israeli hostages, there will be 1,000 boxes of medicines for Palestinian cases. We obviously don't know and have no way of verifying whether those medicines will get to the hostages. The Israeli president, who's speaking at the Davos Economic Forum, has said that he sincerely hopes and prays that they will get there. We know that there are about 105 or so Israeli hostages that are believed to still be alive inside Gaza, and that's a mix of civilians and some soldiers who were taken. Some of them are very elderly, and about half of them are believed to be in need of medication. And this has been something that has been troubling the Israeli families of the hostages for some time. They've been appealing to the Red Cross, the ICRC, and have been complaining that they haven't managed to get medicines to them. So this deal very much is there to reassure the families, to try and keep these hostages healthy. But also, I imagine, it will be a sign to the hostages themselves that their cases haven't been forgotten. In the meantime, no real sign of a breakthrough for a ceasefire deal that would include the release of those hostages. But at least this is some progress in terms of diplomacy, and we haven't seen that for a few weeks.
And meanwhile, the Israeli bombardment of Gaza continues.
The military operation is supposed to be moving into a less intense phase, but it doesn't feel that way to the citizens and the displaced people who are in Khan Yunis at the moment. The fighting is very close to the centre of that city, and people are therefore moving a few kilometres further south to the border town of Rafah, which is right on the Egyptian border. That town has now been swollen, the UN estimating that about 1.4 million people who are moving to the bottom end of the Gaza Strip. And the concern now is that the one town, Rafah, that hasn't seen a major military assault may be in line for the same treatment, and that would have catastrophic consequences for those displaced people, but also would necessarily suspend all aid shipments into Gaza, because that's the route and that's the distribution node for all that aid right at the bottom of the Gaza Strip.
Joe Floto in Jerusalem. In the biggest corruption scandal in Singapore of recent times, the Transport Minister, S. Iswaran, has resigned after appearing in court to face multiple charges. He pleaded not guilty to 27 alleged offences, including obstructing the course of justice. He's accused of obtaining tickets to the Singapore Formula One Grand Prix, as well as to football matches and shows in Britain, from a property tycoon. With more, here's our Singapore business reporter, Mariko Oi.
When Mr. Iswaran and property tycoon Ong Sen Ben were arrested back in July last year, it truly shocked the city-state, because Singapore does have a reputation for clean governance. And this is the biggest political scandal to hit the country in almost four decades. Now, the two men played key roles in bringing the Grand Prix to Singapore in 2008. But Mr. Iswaran has now been given 27 charges, including two for corruption. He's allegedly accepted some tickets to concerts and the Grand Prix, as well as a free flight. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges, but he has just handed in his resignation. And in accepting his resignation, Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong said, "We must uphold the integrity of the party and the government." But actually, this is just the latest in a series of scandals that hit the ruling party. There were extramarital affairs and ministers accused of renting bungalows much cheaper than the market rate. And all these incidents have shaken Singaporeans' trust in the ruling party, the PAP, which has ruled Singapore since its independence in 1965. But it's also raised the question of inequality, because Singapore's MPs are among the best paid in the world. Lawmakers get $12,000 a month, while ministers get $35,000 a month. That's aimed at preventing corruption. Now, Mr. Iswaran was getting a reduced salary of just over $6,000 a month, but he has announced this morning that he will be returning all the money he's earned since the investigation started.
Mariko Oi in Singapore. A man in Thailand has been sentenced to 50 years in prison for insulting the monarchy. It's thought to be the longest sentence ever handed down for the offence. Mongkon Tirakot, a pro-democracy activist, was convicted after posting comments on Facebook. Hundreds of people have been prosecuted in Thailand under strict laws that prevent criticism of the Thai king. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
Thailand now has an elected civilian government for the first time in 10 years. But the much-criticised Les Majesty law, criminalising any negative comment about the monarchy, is still in full swing. The 30-year-old clothing vendor has just received the longest sentence ever imposed under the law, after an appeal court decided to increase his original 28-year term to 50 years. And the judge said he'd already reduced that by a third because of the defendant's cooperative behaviour. The law was briefly suspended at the start of the reign of King Wacharya Longkorn, but has been revived and used extensively since the outbreak of unprecedented student-led protests 3 years ago, which called for sweeping reforms to the monarchy. Details of what prompted such a harsh sentence are not being published. The judge referred to multiple comments on Facebook, and Thai courts typically pile on additional convictions for each individual post. Later this month, the Constitutional Court will rule on whether to dissolve Move Forward, the youthful party which won the most votes in last year's general election, over its call to amend the Les Majesty law, which some Thai conservatives argue amounts to an attempt to overthrow the entire political order.
Jonathan Head. A US spacecraft, which it was hoped would make the first American landing on the moon in more than 50 years, is heading back to Earth after developing a fault. The US company Astrobotic says its Peregrine spacecraft will be redirected to ensure it crashes into the sea. The lander suffered a fuel leak soon after its launch last week. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
Astrobotic's Peregrine lander was in trouble almost as soon as it launched. A breach in a propellant tank made the spacecraft difficult to control. It certainly ruled out any attempt at a lunar landing. The 10 days since have been spent testing the spaceworthiness of other systems, including a suite of NASA scientific instruments. Engineers don't want to leave debris in orbit and will now command Peregrine to make a fiery plunge into the Earth's atmosphere somewhere over the Pacific, far from any population. The craft was hoping to make the first ever landing on the moon by a private company. The achievement of this feat will have to wait a little longer.
Jonathan Amos. Well, despite the involvement of the private sector, space exploration still remains a very expensive endeavour. So why are commercial companies getting involved? Professor Catherine Haymans is a British astrophysicist.
We have a space outer space treaty that restricts people from claiming territory, but there's nothing about mining. And in principle, there are lots of precious metals on the moon that could be essential for, you know, your smartphone and things like that. So there is commercial interest in going there. Controversially, the Peregrine mission also contained human remains that were going to the moon. So there's another sort of human aspect there, which makes scientists feel somewhat uncomfortable, but it's something that maybe we have to embrace if we want to benefit from the cheaper costs of launching these scientific experiments by collaborating with the commercial sector. We don't have a good legal framework for space, and internationally we need to discuss this and do it quickly, because the commercial sector is moving much faster than international law can cope. There's also the risk factor. You know, Musk is famous for saying, if things aren't failing, you're not innovating enough, which is the complete opposite from the national space agencies, where missions do not fail. So it's a new world, but it's one that we are willing to embrace because it allows us to do even more science.
Professor Catherine Haymans. Some of the wealthiest people in the world have gathered in Davos in Switzerland for the annual World Economic Forum. Many are critical of the Davos meeting, which sees the super rich jetting into the glitzy Alpine resort to talk about the global economy. But this year, a large number of the multi-millionaires attending have come up with a surprising solution to reducing poverty. They're demanding to be taxed more, as Stephanie Prentice explains.
So this is an open letter, and it was signed by 250 millionaires and billionaires, and they're asking, even begging, to be taxed more. So on this list, there's people from 17 countries, including the Disney heir, Abigail Disney, Valerie Rockefeller, the US heiress, and the British actor, Simon Pegg. And the title of this letter is Proud to Pay More, and it's not subtle. It says, elected leaders must tax us, the super rich. We'd be proud to pay more. It even breaks down the areas they'd be proud to pay to, and that's education, healthcare, environmental systems. And the letter does let us behind the curtain a bit too. It says they've actually been asking for years to be taxed more, and we do know some of those signing have been campaigning in their own countries, but to no avail. It adds, quite frankly, that more tax would have no impact on their lives or on the lives of their children. And if you're thinking, why don't they make donations or commit to philanthropy? They address that. They say it's not enough because of what they call a colossal imbalance.
And that imbalance, the inequality gap, is widening. There's increasing evidence for that, isn't there?
Yes, so the welfare organisation Oxfam, they've just released a report, and it states the vast majority of wealth is being condensed into just a few hands, in their words. The data says since 2020, the wealth of the five richest people in the world has doubled, while the wealth of the poorest 60% has fallen. So their international exec director, he's in Davos, and he echoed the sentiments of that letter.
We do need to have these fundamental conversations here, that you cannot continue with such levels of obscene economic inequality. So it's important that we cap the CEO salaries, break up monopolies, tax the super rich. We also need to then ensure that living wages are paid across the supply chain.
So that was Amitabh Behar from Oxfam. And he also said having any billionaires in society is, in his words, a failure. And he expressed despair at the prospect of the world's first trillionaire being a real possibility within the next decade.
Stephanie Prentice there, speaking to my colleague Nick Miles. Still to come, the tiny insect invaders that pose a big threat to humans.
In the USA, large numbers of people have been killed by them, and this is something that could be spreading through Europe.
This is the story of the charismatic Nigerian preacher, TB Joshua. Some called him a miracle worker.
He healed the sick, the lame walked.
A great man of God.
Others say they knew a very different man.
He's not this holy man.
What happened to me and to others shouldn't happen to any human being.
This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 2, The Disciples. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Security forces in Uganda have been blockading the homes of the country's two main opposition politicians ahead of a planned protest in the capital, Kampala. Both the former pop star and one-time presidential challenger, Bobby Wine, and another former presidential contender, Kizza Besigye, say soldiers and police officers are preventing them from leaving. The protests about the poor condition of Uganda's roads have been called to coincide with a visit by heads of state who are coming to Uganda to attend an international summit. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told us more about why the police were stopping these leading opposition figures from leaving their homes.
Well, it's something that's happened quite often when the opposition has tried to call demonstrations. The police and the military have often carried out what they've called in the past preventative arrest, trying to stop people from committing crimes before it happens, which is a rather strange way of looking at it. But certainly Bobby Wine and Kizza Besigye have posted on social media about being basically trapped in their homes. And in the case of Kizza Besigye, his wife, Winnie Byanyima, has posted a video where she shows police officers on their own property, basically putting them under house arrest, as it were. This is all partly to do with the fact that there are big summits going on in Uganda, and clearly the opposition wanted to kind of highlight some of the problems Ugandans are facing, and they've got many problems, but one of them happens to be potholes on the roads of Kampala. So they've urged people to go and plant banana plants in those potholes to show them off and show to the world that there are problems going on. But of course, often with opposition protests, then you get the tear gas and the arrests, and the spotlight would be on the opposition rather than on the government showing off what it has achieved at these summits.
Yes, this is all very embarrassing for the government of Uganda's longtime ruler, Yoweri Museveni.
Well, the authorities, it seems, are trying to avoid any bigger embarrassment by allowing these opposition people to build up a head of steam and have huge protests, which they have managed to galvanise before. So rather than that, they think it's better to have headlines that these opposition leaders are under house arrest. And President Museveni, in power since 1986, has always taken a very tough line against the opposition, which has complained that many elections haven't been free and fair and they haven't been free to protest or take part in proper democracy.
And briefly, do you think protesters could still turn out?
There have been a handful, and we've seen photos of people planting these banana leaves, etc. But I don't think, without these characters on the streets, I don't think there'll be very large protests, so that the big summits will go ahead without the opposition kind of being in the spotlight.
Will Ross. Last year saw the biggest influx of asylum seekers to the EU since 2016. More than a quarter of a million of them reached Europe by land and sea, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Many came across the Mediterranean, but the route through the Balkans via Bulgaria has become increasingly important. A network of smuggling organisations facilitates the asylum seekers' onward journey to Western Europe. Nick Thorpe travelled to the northwest of Bulgaria, a region notorious for its poverty and neglect, to meet the people smugglers.
I'm going down some steps into a basement.
Then along a dark corridor, following Slavi, who's leading the way with the light on his mobile phone, into a bare room with a makeshift bar but no drinks. Slavi and his friend Svetlo suggested this as a place we could talk in private. Both were convicted of smuggling migrants, mostly Afghans, across Bulgaria. Slavi was only released from jail 4 months ago, after serving 2.5 years.
Conditions in prison were bad. We were 8 men to a cell, and that's really hard. Each person's supposed to have 4 square metres of space, but in reality, we didn't have 1 square metre. We had to share a bathroom among 110 men, and sometimes there wasn't even enough water for a shower.
It's a desire to highlight these conditions in Bulgarian prisons that has motivated Slavi and Svetlo's decision to talk to me. Slavi's job as a smuggler was to organise other drivers and pick up migrants from the capital and drive them to the border with Serbia.
Well, they were very poor neighbourhoods in Sofia. Incredibly poor neighbourhoods. Very small houses. They were like animal shelters. That's where we used to pick them up from. They were between 18 and 30, I suppose, and they were really hungry and cold, really miserable. You could see the suffering in their eyes.
And it was always men, or women and children too?
There were women and children on one occasion, and when we gave them something to eat, you could see the joy in their eyes.
How many migrants could you carry at one time?
About 8 or 9. Our cars are small and we really had to squeeze them in hard, and to be honest, it wasn't comfortable for us either. And there was another thing, I don't really like to say this, but it wasn't easy for us because it was really smelly in the car.
After 10 runs to the border for Slavi, just 2 for Svetlo, they were caught by police. They were paid €50 per migrant. They blame their arrest on their lowly status. Big-time smugglers, they say, simply pay off the police, an allegation surprisingly confirmed by the man until recently responsible for cracking down on police corruption.
I'm Pavlin Kujakhristov. I work 27 years for Ministry of Interior of Bulgaria, anti-corruption, internal security.
Pavlin switches to Bulgarian.
The most interesting case I had involved a group we arrested in the south of Bulgaria. We knew there was a fifth man who was a member of the border police, but we couldn't identify him. Then a man turned up and said he wanted to turn himself in. It turned out he was the man we'd been looking for, and he brought €1,000 with him. He said that was all he'd got left from what he'd been paid because he'd been getting drunk every night. And he said he'd actually burned some of the money because he was worried it had been marked by the police.
Back in Septemvrici, their village in the dilapidated, sad lands of northwest Bulgaria, Slavi and Svetlo say they won't return to smuggling, even though business is booming. There are big sums on offer. Svetlo just turned down a single run for €15,000, he says. Did you feel guilty about making money out of the misery of these people?
In general now, looking back, I'm not comfortable with that. But that was the situation back then. It was good for the migrants who were escaping, and it was good for me too.
Other smugglers have taken Slavi and Svetlo's places in the long, secretive chain. The big players rarely get caught. The small-timers, like Slavi and Svetlo, from poor, run-down Bulgarian villages, seem not so different from the people they squeeze into their cars for this segment of the Balkan route.
And you can hear more from Nick Thorpe's investigation into the business of people smuggling in Bulgaria on this week's edition of Assignment on the BBC World Service. Sheryl Sandberg, the former chief operating officer of Meta, the company that owns Facebook, has announced that she's stepping down from its board of directors. She said it had been the opportunity of a lifetime, but it felt like the right time to step away. As one of Mark Zuckerberg's senior executives, Sandberg is seen as having played a key role in turning Facebook into a profit powerhouse. Michelle Fleury reports.
Sheryl Sandberg stepped down as Meta's chief operating officer in 2022 after 14 years in the role. Today, she said she wouldn't be seeking re-election to the board when her term runs out in May, a seat she's held for 12 years. In a Facebook post, she said she wanted to spend more time on philanthropic work, but added that she would still serve as an advisor to Facebook's parent company, Meta. Ms. Sandberg was already well known in the tech industry when she joined Facebook in 2008. During her tenure, she helped transform it into one of the most powerful companies in the world and guided it through significant criticism. Commenting on her post, CEO Mark Zuckerberg said her dedication and guidance had been instrumental to Meta's success.
Michelle Fleury. In Queensland, in Australia, fire ants have been filmed building rafts to survive and travel on in floodwaters. It's just one example of the ability of these super pests to invade countries. They've even been found in Europe recently. Jack Goff from Australia's Invasive Species Council told us more about the growing threat they pose to humans.
Look, fire ants are, as you say, one of the world's super pests. Quite a large portion of southern United States does have this invasion of fire ants, which can transform the way of life for societies in terms of people not being able to go outside barefoot, being stung and causing increased numbers of medical visits. Fire ants have come across to Australia about two decades ago from the United States. And fortunately, Australia is probably the world leader when it comes to having really strong biosecurity protocols. There's been a really concerted effort which has limited their spread. And by comparison, in the United States, we've seen fire ants move at a rate of about 40 to 45 kilometres per year up from the south. And in China, they've been moving at about 80 kilometres a year. In Australia, we've kept them to a rate of spread of about 4 to 5 kilometres per year because of the effort of governments. But they're getting into more and more areas and with floods, more active after that wet weather. And they can form these incredible rafts and they have this swarming behaviour, which means that if you disturb their nest, if you step on their nest, they'll come out in really large numbers. And so we see these people covered in welts all over their arms and legs. And in the USA, large numbers of people have been killed by them. And the rate of anaphylaxis, so people having this allergic reaction, is 3 times higher than what it is for bees. And so it can start to put really serious pressure on the health system. And fire ants were actually just found in September last year in Italy. And there are large parts of Europe are also climatically suitable for fire ants to spread. And so this is something that could be spreading through Europe.
Jack Goff. Now to an ethical question that's vexing literary critics in Japan. Does an author deserve an award if part of their book was generated by artificial intelligence? Ryokudan, whose novel Sympathy Tower has won one of Japan's most prestigious prizes, says about 5% of it was generated by the chatbot ChatGPT. She said AI had helped her to unlock her creativity. But now questions are being asked about whether she should have been given an award at all if she didn't really create all the work. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, says she's arguing AI can now be part of the creative process rather than a threat to it.
Do you think somebody who had written a book and admitted that somebody else or something else had written part of that book would be slightly embarrassed by that because it's not their own work? But this isn't what the author Ryokudan actually did. She didn't confess. She just revealed, admitted, said that she'd used these AI programs to generate, she said, 5% of her book was written verbatim by these AI programs. And she said other bits of it were inspired by the interactions she'd had with these programs over the previous months. So perhaps more of it was generated by AI. And as I said, she thought it's part of a creative process, not something to be embarrassed about, but something just to admit and reveal. And it really moves us into a new part of writing and creativity and what is authorship?
Yes, because it's one thing to be inspired, another thing to have ChatGPT writing part of your novel, even if it's only 5%. What have people been saying in response to her revelation?
Well, broadly speaking, there are two camps. There are some people who have praised what she's done, saying, of course, yeah, it just helped the creative process and produces a novel which is far more rich and deep than it would have been had she just written it herself. But of course, there are those that disagree with this and say, really, it's morally wrong. And it's undermined what is one of Japan's most prestigious literary awards.
Mickey Bristow. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Dan Ehrlich. The producer was Ariane Kochi. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katya Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll be looking at the rise of book bans in the United States. Over the past years, an increasing number of popular children's books have been removed from libraries across the US. Some parents say they have legitimate concerns. Others claim this is simply censorship. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.